Mr. Stephen, as you do, I thought of one last question for Mr. Field. Has he left the building?
He is here.
Thank you very much. One final question for you. I've noted that obviously there was L&L on one side of this property and down to the river. On each of the other three sides, apart from area C1 that we've talked about, there is an open space area. Designed to, as it was put in the evidence to us, to accentuate certainly on the lower side, Kiramoko side and Peninsula Bay side, the moraine formation. The question for you is there a danger that an area of residential development above those open space areas is going to sit like a little island up on the hill because of the separation?
Again, it comes down to how it's designed and mm-hmm. through the massive discretion of how that's managed from the, when a facility is lodged, where the platforms are, how much space there is between building platforms, how much mitigation and absorption in terms of vegetation. There is of the buildings. There's an existing building already up on that slope. I don't know the background as to why it's there and how it came about, but it is quite a good illustration of how a building can sit amongst the trees and not be visually dominant or interfere with the moraine. I think the steeper slopes of the moraine I don't think should be built on, and I think the ridge line shouldn't be built on, so there's a sort of a terrace area below the ridge line which has potential for some houses, but how many houses and so forth will need to be worked through with structural planning and further visual effects assessment and so forth. So, but I think, with the large lots going through a rigorous process of assessing visual effects, and maybe that the yield isn't quite 2,000 square metres, or it might be that it's more modulated, particularly with the landfall, so to do with visual effects and so forth. I don't know what the yield would be, but I think there'd be still, nonetheless, quite a bit of open space, let's say unbuilt space, that would retain the unbuilt appearance of the rain landfall.
Thank you for satisfying like that. Curiosity.
Okay.
Appreciate your inputs and thoughts. Coming back in the front, Mr. Crystal.
All right, thank you. I'll try and be as quick as I can get through this. My name is Dean Michael Crystal. I'm a director of Plans Consultants Limited, planning consulting team based in Christchurch. In my substantive evidence, I have described the existing environment, current zoning, history of urban development in the surrounding area, outlined the proposed provisions in the notified plan, discussed the potential land use under the proposed plan, outlined the proposed amendments sought, assessed the relevant effects, undertaken steps to the assessment, including under Section 32 of the RMA, and provided my conclusions. In summary, therefore, Sticky Forest is currently held by the Crown on trust for descendants, the beneficial owners of the 57 original intended owners. It is effectively, therefore, private land, which is currently planted primarily in Pines Radio Yard and Douglas fir trees and contains numerous mountain bike trails. The proposed district plan introduces an O&L overlay to approximately half the site at the northern end and makes the planting of Pines Radio Yard and Douglas fir a prohibitive activity. From an economic productive point of view, the site has limited potential, with the PDP provisions only further limiting the area. The original submission has been refined, with the proposal now being for some 20 of the 50.7 hectares to be zoned for residential purposes, split between low residential density and large light residential. The remainder of the land will be retained for recreational purposes, including a significant part of the mountain bike trails. The proposal includes a redrawing of the proposed O&L boundary and specific policies and rules requiring a process of ensuring that a number of significant matters are addressed prior to consent for subdivision being able to be obtained. Further specific revision is provided in the attached Appendix 1, which I'll get to later. The background and context of this proposal are unusual, if not unique in terms of planning outcomes. It involves consideration of Section 6, 7 and 8 matters and ultimately and importantly in my view an overall judgment in terms of Section 5. Within this framework there are, in my opinion, competing interests and conflicts between landscape values and the economic and recreational values. A further important consideration is the use to which the land can now be put when weighed against the purpose this land was intended in terms of the beneficial owners. The Section 32 assessment attached as Appendix 2 to my evidence in chief considers the rezoning and rules proposed to be a more efficient and effective method of achieving sustainable management than the provisions of the PDP. In terms of rejection policies, I accept there is a degree of tension for those related to the maintenance of landscape character. However, I consider the provisions proposed adequately address these tensions so that the proposal overall will achieve the relevant objectives. Relevant strategic objectives and policies. Now, I've just got a minute to this inquiry because one of the things that you do late at night, you can go on, so I'll go through that with you.
Please.
Further, I do not consider the proposal to be at odds with the strategic provisions associated with urban growth, and can add in there, including policy 4.5.1 of the proposed RPS and those in the PDP. And then continue on, and noting that it will help and promote a more compact, well-designed and integrated urban form. And there's another slight correction in the next paragraph, which will become obvious. Other provisions directed at tangata whenua, such as policy, and it should read 2.1.2, not 4.5.1, of proposed RPS, and objective 5.4.4 and policy 5.4.4.1 of PDPs. In my view, provide support for the proposal. I also note Goal 3.2.7 of the Strategic Directions Chapter requires that the Council will act in accordance with the principles of the Treaty of Waitangi in partnership with Maitake. Nevertheless, the uniqueness of the situation is clearly not anticipated by the entire planning framework. In particular, the operative RPS, although I do not consider the proposal could be said to not give effect to the operative RPS. In this context, therefore, as I understand it, a gap can be said to exist in terms of the King Salmon approach that necessitates a broader analysis and balancing in terms of Part 2, which I have undertaken. I'm just turning to some comments on the Council evidence and matters of the future and hearing. Mr. Barr has suggested that the PDP is perhaps not the most appropriate vehicle for achieving the aspirations of the beneficiaries, bearing in mind the interests of the entire community in terms of Part 2 of the RMA and the outcomes identified in the Strategic Directions Chapter. I'm not sure what other vehicle Mr. Barr considers there might be, but certainly further substitute land is not one of those vehicles. This land is a substitute block, and as I understand it, there is no ability to further substitute it. Notwithstanding this, the district plan has to be part of the process for the beneficiaries to achieve an economic benefit from the land, just like any other landowner. This is clearly why Mr. Beresford had become involved in the process. Mr. Barr also does not consider the Council is required to act as a substitute for the Crown in terms of itself providing redress, particularly when this may have consequences for the wider community. In my view, the Council is not being asked to act as a substitute in providing redress. However, as the body tasked with preparing and implementing district plans, it cannot divorce itself from the issue. Indeed, in my opinion, the Council and its planning regimes have, to a large extent, dictated the situation that currently presents itself. Indeed, To be it needs to be remembered that the land was formerly council land, which was obtained by the Crown for the purpose of economic support and maintenance for the beneficiaries of original descendants. I therefore find it difficult to accept that the council would not have known the purpose for which the land was obtained. Yet over the past 15 to 20 years, various planning studies and plan changes have led to an encroachment of urban growth around the site, with little regard to the site itself, which makes its continued use for any economic rural purpose difficult, if not impossible. Indeed, my reading of many of the documents involved in these processes, while acknowledging the ownership of the site, was private, made no detailed reference to its actual intended purpose. It seems that it was simply assumed that the land was normal rural land and was and could be used for recreational purposes. Indeed, the Wanaka Structure Plan Review states, the structure plan identifies the plantation forest as a potential landscape protection area. This highlights the landscape sensitivity of this area as well as its potential to contribute to open space and recreational networks. Further, the rules regime in the PDP, including the ONL and prohibition of the two forestry species which currently grow on site, has further compromised the site from an economic perspective for beneficial owners. Indeed, Ms. Banks, in her response to a question from the Chair, said that the issue of logging trucks was another reason why Mr. Beresford's submission should not go ahead. It's also important to acknowledge the sequence with which events have occurred, because in my opinion that has some bearing on balancing matters under Part 2. The land was obtained from the Council by the Naitahu Settlement Act in 1998. At that time the land was, and currently is, what land was zoned rural and contained forestry. The surrounding land was also rural, and importantly in my opinion there was no ONL identified on this or any adjoining site. Although I acknowledge there is no actual proof, it seems unlikely that the Crown would have obtained land for the purposes intended if it was known to contain the type of restrictions now proposed in the PDP. In terms of site use, Mr. Farr considered in his rebuttal there would be ample opportunities for appropriate commercial recreational development. Yet at the hearing, he accepted the Chairman's point that if Mr. Greenway says no to the question of whether the mountain biking community is prepared to pay for the use of the site, that would, in effect, circumvent the only practical use across this room that we have been able to identify. Sorry, sir, quoting him, but that's where it came from. Mr. Greenway has now responded saying that a commercial mountain bike park is an unlikely option. In my opinion, therefore, any other commercial recreational development is a very unlikely scenario, which leaves few, if any, options under a rural zoning, other than some form of residential development. And Chairman is right, in my view, to raise the issue of Section 85 of the Act. Mr. Farr does not agree that any benefits arising from having regard to the principles of the Treaty of Waitangi should override the social well-being of the wider community in terms of the potential loss of recreational opportunities and the impacts of the location on urban development hard up against the ONL, where this would be likely to result in inappropriate development. In response, I simply make the point that, one, recreational opportunities cannot be given any significant, if any, weight under Mr. Barr's preferred option of retaining rural zoning, as they could be extinguished at any time. They can only be considered and weighed under the rezoning proposal I have put forward, as that is the only option that secures those recreational opportunities. The ONL is proposed and therefore importantly did not exist in any form at the time the land was obtained by the Crown for the purpose of providing for the beneficiaries. In my opinion, this is an important point in weighing various issues. The question of existing use rights associated with forestry raised on this bar is difficult and in my opinion, one is not easily resolved without court interpretation given the complex list which Mr. Barr acknowledged when he said at the hearing that it might be drawing a long bow. And two, it would be difficult to rely upon going forward. In any event, I doubt very much whether existing use rights would be specific enough to protect the two species currently grown on site, both of which are proposed to be prohibited by the PDP. And this probably answers a question I think that Commissioner Hudson had. In my discussions with Mr. George Platt of RPDF Olsen, who they currently manage the forest, he was unable to identify a committed species which would be grown viably as a commercial enterprise on the site, taking into account its location. Just pause there just to answer a question that arose around the logging and how and the timing and the trucks going out to North Lake. So in my evidence in chief, you might have noticed that I had sought advice on just how long it would take to log the forest. So the total forest that PS Olsen thought it would take 3 to 4 months to log. And they estimated around 10 logging trucks per day. So the 20 hectares, if you come back, the 20 hectares that's proposed to be urbanised, if you like, contains Douglas Firs, and there are a lot of gaps in that area, which are not forest at all. But so I think you could reasonably assume that that area would probably only take a month to get rid of. The trees in there are a lot, the Douglas Firs are quite young, and obviously take a lot longer to grow than pine straight yard, so they're at an early stage. They have been maintained, but whether if you were logging them tomorrow, they would be of use as logs, it's probably questionable. So I guess that's probably as far as I can take you on that, but I think you're probably talking about 3 or 4 weeks to log it, maybe upwards of 10 truck movements a day to take that. Just in conclusion, the competing interests and conflicts, in my opinion, lie between the landscape values, particularly associated with the proposed OML, and the other values, namely recreational, community, and economic. The landscape values are contained primarily in the geography and visibility of the site. The existing exotic trees, while prominent on the site, are not a particularly integral part of those values, and the PDP, in my view, sets itself against forestry within an OML, and certainly the species of tree currently on site. This is perhaps one of the conundrums of the PDP proposed bringing an OML over the site. On the other hand, the current forestry is an integral part of the recreational values of on the site. The ability to ride trails in amongst and between well-established trees is an integral part of the enjoyment obtained from mountain biking through this area. There is also conflict between landscape values and the economic use of the site. The OML area makes the continuation of forestry difficult, and the prohibition of pine straight yard and Douglas Firs make it even less likely. I note that at the time in 1998 when the substitute block was selected, the site was owned rural and there was no OML boundary nor a prohibition on pine straight yard and Douglas Firs planting. The PDP makes the continuation of this land use at best marginal. Other activities are also restricted by the landscape values attributed to the site. Balancing these competing and conflicting interests and values is complex. In my opinion, one needs to first and look at the purpose for which the land has been provided. It essentially stems from a breach of the treaty principles dating back more than 100 years, Trout redress being to provide for the economic sustenance, which I equate to well-being, of the descendants of the original beneficiaries. These descendants, therefore, should be enabled to utilise the land for some form of economic purpose rather than having it further alienated by the district being prisoners. While I accept that landscape values are important, in this instance I consider the resulting benefits for both the beneficial owners in economic terms and the community in recreational terms, which cannot be guaranteed in any other way, outweigh the relatively modest landscape effects. In my opinion, the economic well-being and of beneficial owners and community well-being, which are captured in Section 5, outweighs the landscape values in Section 6 now being proposed. In this context, I note that the proposal still maintains an OML across approximately half the site, with design controls on the more visibly sensitive areas. So it's not that Section 6 is being ignored or trumped. Rather, it's around the margins where I lean more towards Sections 5, 8, with Section 6 still taking prominence in the most visually significant areas. The proposed planning regime, in my opinion, delivers a balanced outcome in terms of landscape and amenity values, and also provides significantly for both economic and community well-being in the form of guaranteeing the economic well-being of the beneficial owners and future recreational access. At the same time, the proposal would help in redressing a broader treaty matter which has been outstanding for over 100 years. Finally, should the panel consider within the proposed rules there is insufficient protection within the 4 hectare area between what I call the orange and yellow lines on the plan in this field's evidence and wish to maintain the OML boundary proposed for the field, I propose further additional changes in Appendix 1 below. My opinion, the original changes proposed were sufficient and that they would require similar outcomes by a structured plan preparation process. However, I accept that the panel may have a different view to that. Just one other point that I think arose from Commissioner McLeod in relation to the building restriction area along the North Lake side of the site. So that's rule 12X. 12.X.4.5 Roman numeral 7. So this is plan change, so North Lake plan change. So non-compliant activity, building restriction area, any building and any domestic cutelage activities, including gardens, paved areas, and parking, in brackets, except for the purpose of vehicle access, in activity areas E1 to E4. So this area, the area bordering the site is E1 and E4, and so therefore a road through that area is not covered by that rule, so that would be permitted.
I'm just saying potentially that's
I think well you've got an area over on that edge anyway that North Lake have so they can put some housing in there as well, so I guess it's a go if they want to put a road through there to that area they can. I don't know whether you want me to take you through that rule or whether you like to.
I think we're good. Thank you, Mr. Crystal. Relating to your last point, the question I asked Mr. Field, we need to know the answer to. I wonder if you do, which is, at what point in the North Lake process are they going to get to area C1?
That's a good question. And there, only appeal structure plan doesn't actually show a road across there at all. So I guess you could say that the timeline is sometime in the future. It might be some distant future. So there's no the structure plan that's online show development so far, but those C areas, and there are a few of them, it's not just the one, don't have any roading shown to them.
Thank you. Other point of clarification. Paragraph 10 of your summary, the classic double negative. I do not consider that the proposal could be seen not to give effect.
Yes. So what I'm saying.
What are you actually saying?
I'm saying that I don't think you could argue that it doesn't give effect to the offer draft.
Is it required by the RPS, the operative RPS, or is it consistent with it?
I think it's consistent with it. I mean, I think one of the issues with the operative RPS is it doesn't actually, in terms of the St. Fenner version, it doesn't actually go. So it's neutral.
I'm
buying
into a balancing operative RPS doesn't have very many places in it. It's a remarkably neutral document. I'll spend a long time to say very little.
And I think it's supplemental of all those early RPS.
Commissioner Hudson.
Mr. Crystal, just a preliminary question. You've outlined the statutory framework within which you've considered the plan change, and you've talked about balancing various provisions. So do I take it that in the light of the discussion this morning between the Chair and Stephen that you're taking legal guidance on the approach, or is it your view as a panel? the appropriate approach to take?
I have talked to Mr. Evans about that consent. That's an evolving area. I guess the Davison decision has made it evolve even further. But my understanding is that I look at this as being a very unique situation, and in fact, so unique that it's the only one that's in the Queensland Lakes area and indeed the Otago Regional Council area. So, for that reason, there is a gap, I guess, in the policy framework, both in terms of the regional provisions and the district provisions. So, I get you to part two and enables you to undertake an overall balancing of the various competing interests. In other words, it's not actually being addressed in the policy framework.
Yeah, it's just I'm interested in the language that then flows through to the draft zoning provisions where you talk about balancing, and I wonder whether in fact that language is given the recent case law, whether that's still appropriate. So that's not even so much enough to use the words of for us to
I don't know specifically the context in which that is being used in the plan provisions, but I think that there's been a bit of a somewhat of an overreaction to Ken Salmon and the extent that there is a suggestion that sort of balancing approaches to processes now. That's certainly not the case. And when we're talking about those planned provisions, we haven't got a lot of documents that fully reflect that about 2 metres. I think, King Sam's case, you can have regard to part two. And that was a King Sam was a case of sort of whether you could invoke part the enabling aspect of section 5 for the purpose of outweighing impact on Section 6 values in the context of an issue of coastal policy status where there was a very clear directive in a policy that development in those areas had to be outweighed. And it would be around that by invoking the enabling provisions of Section 5. And the court said, no, you can't do that because the New Zealand coastal policy statement subsumed part 2 matters and it's sort of done the balancing. And it's all there, and that's where the buck stops. But it's not the situation we're in. So I don't think that there's any difficulty with sort of taking a balancing approach in this context.
Question for you, Ms. Stephen. I understand that certainly that interpretation of King Salmon is open to you. Have the Court of Appeal pushed that position further in matter of law to the point where section 6 is about a bottom line? We discussed that this morning, and your position is, as far as the case you identified, you're running is concerned, that only is an issue for that 4 hectares that Mr. Field described. As a point of principle,
I'd like to go back and read Man of War again just to understand the context in which it was being suggested. I read the case, but I can't remember the facts of it with special detail to understand the context in which it might be now suggested that that is said, but Section 6 is always going to be bottom line. I would be cautious in suggesting that it is authority for that.
Read paragraph 61.
Even is it in the context of the National Coastal Policy
Statement? No.
It's not.
The clause of extension that says it's the same if the CPS applies than if it doesn't.
Okay, so is that okay? Well, that would be interesting because it suggests that section 6 takes priority on section 5, doesn't it?
Yes.
And but it also definitely sets in place a very rigid hierarchy in the context of all parts of the matters.
All the above.
Yes. So I think you can have a look at that. I'd be surprised if it's that far.
Well, we're the same. I wouldn't want you to get the idea that it's currently a paragraph from Swahiba. I was discussing it with the class.
Yeah. No, I remember paragraph 45 of one of Judge Jetson's decision, because it was a great point that I had to have was off to Wikipedia, just so this is when we started to talk about it. So I don't care about who just stick out and
Going back to your evidence in chief, paragraph 77, section 32 evaluation, I just wondered, particularly in the light of the Stephen Commission this morning, whether you agree that the third zone is another method.
It is open to, and to be fair, we started with the third zone, and then we felt, well, we think we can craft a rule package in there with that non-compliant state. In my view, it's just about the same thing. So I think what you're getting at is the roading issue at the end of the day. I think the point I'd make is that there has to be a solution to that. You can't continue to have a site which is landlocked. So if you come from a proposition that there will be a solution, now whether that solution is negotiated with adjoining landowners or it becomes forced on joint or through Crown negotiations, there will be a solution. So just that's a question, probably more a question of how long that's going to take. But I think, in my view, there will have to be a solution. You just cannot have landlocked land. Mm-hmm. And there will have to be a solution. So whether you defer it or whether you leave it as we propose as non-compliant, I don't think it actually matters. But yes, we did start as deferred, and then we felt, no, we can actually do it this way. Because I guess deferment, and look, a lot of councils don't like deferred zones. I've had this battle.
There is one in the proposed zone.
Yes, I know, and I'm very aware of that. And a lot of councils don't like it, and that's why we went back to the non-compliant status, like where we've gone, for the subdivision, and requiring structure plan to be prepared and all that stuff to be done. I think it's just about the same thing for me.
Just a spatter of interest, when we discussed this issue with Mr. Barr, he said, although he would normally,
yes, I know, I heard that.
normally support a third zone, despite the exception of Bruce Law.
Mm, mm, mm.
Just on that, we heard also that there is a potential problem with the activity statement of forestry,
yes,
and whether or not the rural. A rural zone in the meantime enables a solution to get out
of the nation. On reflection, and this thing is correct, it probably should be a controlled activity rather than permitted, because you've obviously got, and look, we can come back with some criteria around that, but that would be helpful, because obviously in forestry and harvesting, there are some issues that you've got to deal with, laid in areas and probably traffic management plans and things like that. So, but I think that I heard the chairs on the transcripts the scope issue. My way of looking at it was to come from the other angle, and that forestry is not prohibited in the current zone. So it's a discretionary activity, so the rural zone has discretionary activity, so it's not permitted there, so there is scope to have something else. And I think you wouldn't want to make it discretionary in the living zone would suggest that you could decline it, which would frustrate the zoning. So my view, it's seen as a component of the rezoning, but yes, I would agree that it probably needs to be conceded at a controlled activity stage, so there is some conditions put around how that harvesting occurred.
Well, good.
While we're talking, 5 p.m. on the 21st, you have to provide us with a new controlled activity rule.
I'm aware of that.
Just on this aspect of what an activity status might infer. We're doing an argument this morning that from another discretionary activity status is essentially is providing for the activity. So you're arguing.
Well, yeah, I think that comes with, that's the old Swinley case. Swinley case from Waipa District, isn't it? I thought that had been well and truly gone.
Well, the curious thing is I always cite the discretionary activity board for any development building going out on the Queenstown Lakes District Council operative plan is an example where the criteria, certainly strictly the criteria, will be applied stringently to the extent that consent will be granted in an exceptional case. So that's the complete opposite of that.
It's the old conditional use
argument. And it's a discretionary activity.
And objectives and policies. Now, turning to some of your suggested new rules, you referred to the rule that this is what I want to ask you, sites on Mount Iron located above 330 metres.
Yes.
As a rule that could be expanded to include sticky forest.
Yes.
So, can you just confirm for me whether that is an existing rule in the PDP, or is this one that has been put forward subsequently by
LNB
in relation to the...
No, I'll take this. We've got in the PDP. We've used the rule straight out of the PDP.
Okay.
Not any new ones being put forward by us.
Okay, so that's, what is the 330 metre station? That's in relation to obviously Mount Iron, so it doesn't have any.
No, because it's 330 metres is Mount Iron and ends the end within Sticky Forest, so the 330 metres is really nothing to do with Sticky Forest.
Now, in 27. 8x3, you refer to preparation of a structure plan for the entire Sticky Forest area.
Mm-hmm.
And then in your revised wording and additional wording in your supplementary statement today, you suggested a comprehensive development plan for subdivision.
Sorry, that's, so the revised meeting only relates. No, the revised meeting only relates to the area, the 4 hectare area that sits between, if I can put it like this, Mr. Corso and Alan Mayo.
So, are we talking about the same method, but by a different name?
You could call it if you wanted. We called it a comprehensive development plan because it was there was a lot more in there than. Being a wider structure plan, so it's gone into a lot more detail. The other way you could deal with this is that you could take those criteria there and put them into D over the page. So 27.8x3, where it goes to D, the extent of any specific building control is necessary to manage landscape effects. And you could take those and put those in there for that particular area. That would be the other option. So you would say in the area inside the ONL. So what I've done with the appendix is assume that it goes back to being within an ONL, and you have a whole lot of criteria that relate specifically to that 4 hectare bit that's inside the ONL.
We've had a big debate with each of these issues relating to ONRs about whether urban development can be in.
Yes, and that's the reason why I went for not being in the ONL. I found it difficult to craft something that would be allowed for development inside an ONL when you have a whole suite of criteria. Which people say only can happen in very exceptional circumstances and criteria along those lines. That might open up a whole can of worms, and hence the reason why I went down the track.
Speaking of can of worms, isn't that exactly what the Court of Appeal in Manitoba said we can't do? which is decided in the LDL lining, is by reference to what we want and allow in it, that it's a landscape issue. Landscape issue first, and then decide what you might and might not limit.
And maybe we'll
go
like
a in terms of drafting, that's the fact that you've now got some suggested revisions. I'd like to suggest to the chair that as part of the additional materials and rituals that you incorporate
into the
other as a comprehensive.
Yes, correct. Yeah, I understand. By being on the 21st.
But going to the additional criteria that was suggesting, I just wondered whether matters for discretion are appropriately framed, as in the first part, the exercise of discretion limited to the degree to which the comprehensive development plan identifies the following matters. So what are the first part of that, the actual matters for discretion be? Relocation of building platforms, the architectural design of buildings, landscaping for all the areas in the RML. And then below that would be the assessment criteria. Was that?
So we're saying that.
So first of all, you've got to identify the matters for discretion.
Yeah.
And then you have the extent to which those matters are to be assessed and what matters have to be covered.
Yeah.
Is that?
Yeah.
Frankly, I haven't got my head fully around this. So in terms of detail, I was at the point of looking at the broader provisions that were being put up, and so I have not got into the actual detail drafting.
Which I suppose is an invitation. If you have second thoughts, at a level of detail, we're prepared to receive. I'm good, thank you, Mr. Crystal.
So that's the end of my case. I would like to just go back and have a look at that Man of War case in paragraph 61 in particular, but I suspect that there's all sorts of terms of what's inappropriate, because you're right that landscape and our O&L has to be identified by reference to its character, its qualities, irrespective of what independently and the implications to produce. But the second stage of that is what is inappropriate and development that has to be avoided. And so I'm prepared to accept that Man of War probably says that it will be avoided. But it all turns on what is inappropriate. And in the NZCPS, it has said, with reference to particular map areas, where muscle tones would be inappropriate. So that was already decided, so there's no judgment and there's no wiggle room. So that we have decided what's inappropriate development in the areas in question. And so what we're saying here is that what we're proposing is not inappropriate.
Thank you very much, Ms. Steele, and to your team. Mr. Field's got some homework. Mr. Crystal's got some homework. We'll look forward to receiving their additional material. And so we appreciate the amount of work you put into your evidence and your submissions to assist us with our deliberations. Thank you.
meet us.
Yeah, welcome. Lucky last.
I'll take that for a moment.
I suggested here in Australia giving a Roman commission. But the last of the schedule was probably appropriate. The other thing I should reassure you is we've allowed you an hour for the schedule, and you've got an hour. You sit until 5:15.
Right. I timed it this morning 45 minutes, so there will be questions as well. No sticky. No.
Indeed.
Of course, it's a little bit grungy. Sorry to cry that. But I just have 2 minutes sort of stuff out.
Must have run just the danger in time. Not so.
Okay.